Hello, everyone. My name's Nick Wagner.
And I'm Diana McAlevey.
Welcome to another edition of RCI's Secret Sauce, where we give you the ingredients for a great catechumenate.
Today, we're going to answer a question from a listener about what to do if a person who is being received into the Catholic Communion cannot make it to the Easter Vigil. Second, we're going to take a look at a resource that will help your parishioners explore the deeper significance and meaning of the Sunday Mass. And finally, we are continuing our exploration of the Creed.
So let's start with our question. We got a question from a listener about a person. They have a baptized person that wants to become Catholic and cannot come to the Easter Vigil, a big scheduling conflict, and actually would rather be confirmed by the bishop at the diocesan celebration of confirmation. So what are the options for this person? That's the question.
Yeah, so there's a lot going on in this person's question. And so let's take one part at a time. And we've talked about this many times in the various podcasts over the years. But first off, the primary place where you would celebrate the rite of reception, so we're talking about those who are baptized validly in a Trinitarian baptism with water, but in another Christian denomination.
Other than Catholic.
Other than Catholic.
These are not Catholics.
Yes. The normative place for the celebration of that rite of reception is not the Easter Vigil. In fact, the national statutes for the catechumenate in the United States, if you turn to paragraphs 32 and 33... of those statutes, it will say that it should ordinarily take place at the Sunday Eucharist of the parish community. And in paragraph 33, it's preferable that it not take place at the Easter Vigil.
So the fact that this person cannot make the Easter Vigil is kind of fortuitous because it shouldn't take place at the Easter Vigil.
And it should take place as soon as the person is ready. There's no need for anyone to wait until the Easter season to celebrate the rite of reception. So it happens at any Sunday Eucharist of your parish community.
Now, what about this person's desire to be confirmed by the bishop?
Well, that's a different question. The rite of reception is made up of various parts, so the liturgy of the word as usual, and then the celebration of reception itself, which starts off with the person professing the faith along with the assembly, so in one of the creeds.
So the creed or baptismal promises.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And then the next part is that the person who's being received says a one-line statement that they believe everything the Catholic Church teaches and professes.
So they make this declaration of their profession of faith, mm-hmm, at the end of the communal profession,
exactly,
of faith.
Mm-hmm. And then the third part is that the person is formally received by a statement that the presider says, basically saying, I receive your statement of faith and welcome into the Catholic Communion.
And that's kind of the magic moment. That's when they become Catholic. Yeah.
And then that moment is then sealed by confirmation. And confirmation must happen immediately after a person is received, assuming that the person has not been validly confirmed already.
Yeah.
So most cases, that is the case. We must confirm. So unless the bishop is receiving the person's profession of faith, then the bishop cannot confirm this person.
But usually, like in our diocese, I think in most dioceses, that diocesan celebration of confirmation of adults that happens around Pentecost in a lot of dioceses, mm-hmm, that's for Catholics who never got confirmed along,
yeah,
the way. They're not being received into the Catholic Church.
Exactly.
They're already part of the full community of the Catholic Church. They just miss confirmation.
So the biggest issue in this person's question, the misconception that is revealed in this, is that the rite of confirmation is the same as the rite of reception. They're very distinct rituals for very distinct people.
So you won't find the rite of reception, for example, then in the book, the rite of confirmation. It doesn't exist there.
Yeah.
You'd have to go actually to the RCIA. The rite of reception is in the appendix of the RCIA,
yeah,
and that's a separate rite.
Yeah. So the takeaway here is realize that the rite of reception is different than the rite of confirmation, even though confirmation is part of both.
And so the confirmation will happen in the rite of reception if the person is not already validly confirmed, which most Protestant people are not. Who does the priest need to get permission from the bishop to do the confirmation?
He does not. He is given permission by canon law, and it's actually mandated that he confirm the person that he receives. So he needs no permission from the bishop to confirm that person. You might want to double check with your diocese to make sure that the priest has permission to receive.
He does. The ordinary minister of reception is the bishop.
Yes.
So if the priest wants to receive someone, he needs to get permission from the bishop. But almost every other diocese in the United States, that permission goes along with becoming a pastor. Yes. So if you're the pastor, you have automatically been delegated permission to receive.
Okay. All right. So hopefully that clears up the questions about rite of reception.
All right. So the next thing that we want to talk about is a resource that, again, this will probably make a little bit more sense to you after we talk about the creed, but we're going to introduce the resource here. And Diana might have to correct my Spanish. It's a double title. It's a bilingual book called Feast of Faith, Fiesta de la Fe.
Oh, muy bien.
Gracias. So this is a really interesting resource. It's 52 bite-sized bits of description about the Sunday Mass and why we celebrate the Sunday Mass and what all the different pieces are about as we go through it. So the idea is you can put this in your Sunday bulletin every week of the year to give your parish assembly a little deeper understanding of why we do what we do, and you can do it in both your English bulletin and your Spanish bulletin. It's got both languages, and it also has a CD included that has all of those, so you can just copy them off the CD and paste it right into your bulletin.
And who are the authors?
The authors are Karina Laughlin and Miguel Arias.
Yes.
And it's published by World Library Publications, and we'll have a link to this on the website where you'll find this podcast.
But the reason to use this resource is because the Sunday liturgy itself is a powerful encounter with the risen Christ, and for many, many layers of reasons. Sunday liturgy versus, say, Monday daily mass or Friday Taizé service. Those are good things to do, but the Sunday Eucharist itself in the midst of the community is the premier encounter with Christ. And many times we need some ways to help people enter more deeply into that encounter so that they see what's happening with a clearer lens of the richer symbolism and meaning of those actions and words, but also give them ways to reflect on afterwards what they just experienced. And so these bite-sized bulletin insert kind of reflections can help families do that, can help individuals reflect more deeply on their premier encounter with Christ in the Sunday Mass.
And again, that leads right into what we're going to talk about with the creed. So the section on the creed that we're going to do this week, Diana, would you read that for us?
So, we are pretty much halfway done. The two lines that we're focusing on here is, He ascended into heaven and is seated at the right hand of the Father.
And the resource that we've been using to help us go through the creed is a book titled The Creed by Barrett L. Motheller. And we had featured that in a previous podcast. You can go back a few weeks and get the link for that if you don't already have it. But Motheller said, he asked this question at the beginning of the discussion of this section. He says, how is it that the church taught so effectively in the early days, before we had schools and programs and such? If you think about the very early church and even up through the medieval era, there weren't really anything like we think of with modern, in the sense of modern catechesis and modern pedagogy like we use today. So, and yet we seem to, I don't know about the rest of you out there, but I sometimes have the feeling that our catechesis is not very effective, that we have, folks are not really getting it widespread across the different age groups and cultures of the church. We get a lot of people, we talk about how there's a real lack of understanding of the faith. Mm-hmm. And Motheller says, how come people understood the faith so clearly in past days when we didn't have all these very, you know, well-designed and well-executed catechetical programs in schools and such. Why is that?
Well, it sounds like his premise, his thesis in this part of the book, is that the primary reason that the early Christians understood so well the meaning, the deep meaning of their faith, is that they focused primarily on the Sunday gatherings and the liturgical year.
Well, you know, as a liturgist, that just warms my heart to hear that. but there's something to that. If you think about that, even today, where's the bulk of the Catholics that we interact with on a regular basis? Where are they? You know, they're at the Sunday Mass, and then even these bulletin inserts that we talked about, we can provide things like that. We can provide excellent catechetical programs. We can provide schools. But how many Catholics really are impacted by those versus the numbers of Catholics who come to Sunday Mass?
Mm-hmm. I mean, so Martha Lur here is moving into the sense of the liturgical year and connecting that with the sense of the 40 days from the resurrection to the ascension.
Mm-hmm.
And for those who really attend to the movement and the flow and the symbolism of the time itself and the symbolic meaning of time and the ritual way we use time, it transforms all of their days, not just their Sunday experience. But Sunday begins then to infiltrate the way they live the rest of their week in their daily life, right?
Yep. So just to take this example of the ascension, he ascended into heaven and is seated at the right hand of the Father. The reason most of us even know about that mystery is because of the Sunday liturgy. It's not, you know, maybe we studied it in catechesis when we were children or something, but really I remember going to Mass on Ascension Thursday. You know, now that's in a lot of places moved to Sunday, but it's still that sense of celebrating that feast in particular that starts to inculcate in us a sense of what it is for Jesus to go up, to be raised up. But the difficulty, I think the shift between the early church and even the medieval church and modern times is, in modern times, we've developed a much more literal understanding of that ascension. So for lots of Catholics, I encounter this sometimes when I do workshops, for lots of Catholics, there's a sense that it was that Jesus literally walked around on earth for 40 days after the resurrection. At the end of 40 days, his time was up, and then he ascended into heaven.
Mm-hmm. And who is it? Is it Luke who is the only one who talks about that 40-day period?
Yeah, of all the writers in the New Testament, including St. Paul, Luke is the only one who talks about the 40 days, and which is interesting because Luke wasn't around at that time. Luke was a later convert to the faith, and the 40 days happened before Luke ever became a Christian.
But obviously the idea of 40 days or a 40-day period or some kind of period of sort of in-betweenness had some deeper symbolic meaning for Luke.
And Luke actually, even though he wasn't Jewish, is drawing on a Jewish tradition when he says that. All of us know the 40 years in the desert and the 40 days flood. And this number 40 comes up over and over again. Mm-hmm. And the number 40 isn't ever meant to be actually 40 exact days or 40 exact years. It's symbolic of, in the sense of wandering in the desert, it's symbolic of a generation. So the generation that was in slavery died out, and the new generation is who comes into the promised land.
So it's a new creation. It's another way of the 3 days mm-hmm. of total transformation. It's another way of saying that after this period, what arises, what is raised up, what ascends, is something completely different than what was there before.
Yeah, so Luke is saying exactly that then. We're embarking on a new era, not necessarily that Jesus was around for 40 actual days, mm-hmm. but something about Jesus now is brand new, and that's symbolized by this number 40 and by the ascension itself, that we're embarking on a brand new thing that's never happened before.
And now John's gospel does the ascension in a different way, which connects really well then to this sense of 40 days, looking at time in a new way.
Yeah, in John's Gospel and all the Gospels, the resurrection and the ascension happen on the same day. They happen on Easter. There's no except for Luke, there's no division in time. And John is the clearest of all the Gospel writers of connecting the resurrection and the ascension with the crucifixion. So for John, there's this continual lifting up. Jesus is lifted up on the cross. Mm-hmm. He's raised up on the third day, and then he's drawn up, lifted up into heaven at the conclusion of that rising, that lifting up. But it's all one movement for John of being lifted up. They're not really three separate events. It's all one event in one moment that happens for John.
And even for John, John's gospel is very. It uses a lot of the Greek ideas and Greek philosophy. And if you remember from the beginning of John's gospel, the first act of the Word was for the Word to come down and dwell among human beings. Mm-hmm. And so it's this descending mm-hmm. that is then leading to the ascending of Christ. And so it's this real expression of one moment of God's relationship with God's people expressed throughout this lifetime of this one person.
And in the early church, that was the way people got that message was liturgically. That Paschal mystery was celebrated kind of in one event in the weekend of Passover, the weekend after Passover, and it wasn't separated as we do now with yeah. Ascension happened 40 days later. That really started about the 4th century. So for centuries, the church sort of had a John sense of the Paschal mystery and the way we celebrated worship. Yeah. But even after the 4th century or so, when we began to separate the feasts out more, there was still a sense, it was still a sense of the symbolic, the deeper, more powerful meaning of this, that they were all connected, even though we celebrated them at separate times.
And so I've heard some people say, and I know none of our listeners have said this, but some other people have said things like where they take liturgical time so seriously. So, for example, on Good Friday, they say, oh, Jesus isn't risen yet. We can't do that because Jesus isn't risen. That's just ridiculous because if Jesus isn't risen, then what are we doing here? You know? And so it's this literal understanding of time that sort of misses the whole point of what God did for human history.
Yeah, and the earliest writer in the New Testament is St. Paul, and St. Paul is really clear on what God did for human history, because Paul is not considered a gospel writer because he's got no stories about Jesus before the resurrection. Everything for Paul starts at the resurrection. Mm-hmm. And Paul has that kind of sense with John about what the resurrection means. And for Paul especially uses this phrase a lot, justification. So the resurrection is the principal element in our justification. Now, we might use a different word today, like salvation, but they're roughly the same meaning. But when we talk about salvation, when I was a kid, that was something that God did to me, you know, and that there's sort of still that sense that God saves us. But think about it, saves us for what? Our understanding of salvation is that we're drawn into a relationship. Mm-hmm. And the ascension, you were talking about this, Diane, about the ascension being the beginning of God doing that drawing up or drawing us into relationship.
Yeah, and so when we say that line, he ascended into heaven and is seated at the right hand of the Father, it's really clear there that Jesus the Son and the Father are in this unified relationship, and the mission of that relationship, the work of that love between Father and Son, is to send out the Holy Spirit to draw all creation to the Father, to bring all of humanity to its fullest stature of union with Christ in God the Father. And if you think about it, the sense of being drawn together, that's the meaning of church. The Greek word for church is ekklesia, the people who are called and drawn together. And so our greatest destiny is to be united, to be ascended with Christ into the realm of the Father.
So when we talk about catechesis, and when Mothler asks at the beginning of this section, how was it the church was so well catechized? That is exactly what we mean by catechesis, to get that point, that we're drawn up into that relationship with the Father and the Son through the action of the Holy Spirit. Mm-hmm. And they got that. They got that catechesis through the celebration of the liturgy.
Yeah.
And there was nothing else. There weren't schools, there weren't programs, there weren't Sunday bulletins, there weren't bulletin inserts. And so, you know, I think we need to continue to do all these great things that we do outside the liturgy, but our primary focus has to be on what's happening on Sunday. And for the 90% of folks who aren't going to come to our groups and are not going to come to our catechesis, you're not going to read the Sunday bulletin, what is it we're doing in the Sunday liturgy that will catechize them to understand that salvation relationship with the Father and the Son?
So we've been trying to connect all of these understandings of the Creed to give you ideas on how to communicate these understandings to the various levels needed for catechesis. For those of us in the third level, the ongoing formation that all the baptized go through, we can understand all of these technicalities of liturgical time and symbolism, but if they're not manifested in our daily life in such a way that communicate to those in the first level, those who have no relationship yet with God the Father, those who are still seeking for some deeper meaning, then anything we do on Sunday makes no difference then. Our purpose is to manifest the change that we've encountered at Sunday Eucharist for those who need to hear that good news.
And for the folks in the second level, which are primarily our catechumens, a couple of things that we want to look for in them. One is that they don't get into this literal understanding of the liturgical year, that it's these exact days at these exact moments, but rather it's a deeper metaphor and symbolism of the relationship of Jesus to the Father and this new day, this new thing we're trying to express. That's the point of the liturgical year they need to get.
And paradoxically, one way that they can break out of that literal understanding of the liturgical year is to observe the liturgical year even more closely and with more attention in their daily lives, so that what we are celebrating together as church on Sunday is drawn into their daily life throughout the week.
Well, that's about all the time we have, and I'm really, really grateful you stayed with us through this. This is a little bit of a complex section of the Creed, but I think it's a really important one, so thanks for your attention to it.
Before we go, we have a webinar coming up the first week of March, Thursday, March 5th. And I know that many of you are celebrating Rite of Election this week and are continuing on this Lenten journey. And so our theme for the webinar is how to share your Paschal mystery story with the catechumens.
All right, everyone. We hope to see you there, and we hope to see you next week for our podcast. We're glad you were with us this time. My name is Nick Wagner.
I'm Diana McAleenan.
This has been another Team RCA Secret Sauce.